Michael Frazis, listeners, welcome to Double or Nothing. What's been happening, or what's in your mind, Mike?
Hi, Misha. Look, it's been an interesting couple of weeks since we last spoke. I think when we did, it was like everything was like at the lows. It was kind of, we knew there was an inflation print coming out, and then every year, each one of those felt like being like hit with a baseball bat in the stomach because they kept coming in hot, and some of the biggest sell-offs this year happened after those numbers. But actually, it came in the opposite direction. It came in light, and so now you've got this strange situation where the last 4 months on an annualized basis. US inflation is at 2.8%, and almost all of that is shelter housing rents, which we know are falling dramatically. They're just not being picked up in the data. So if you're actually at something like 2.8%, and even that component, the majority of that is actually shrinking, could be in a deflationary environment really quick. And that's not just, I tell people this, they don't really believe it. So the 2.8% comes from the Wall Street Journal. And obviously you can check the numbers yourself on everything else, but German purchasing of Germany PPI just came in negative as well, like the one of the biggest negative readings they ever had. So again, on a month-on-month basis, that's deflationary.
So on like a 12-month view, like what does deflation always sounds like very macro and technical, but really is all you're saying is that energy prices and food, because supply chains, like just like the cost of stuff and inputs globally is going to go down over a while. Is that all that means, or does it mean something else?
It's more like what is the current rate of change? So it's currently prices are falling across the board. So you can see that in autos, goods and services, huge retail inventories everywhere, shipping rates collapsed, ports empty where they used to be full, semiconductors, prices falling. We've seen that everywhere for a while, rents falling, home prices falling. I mean, you can see that everywhere. It just hasn't popped up in the data yet. In terms of what it means, well, the year-on-year numbers are still positive, like kind of 6-7%, and that's because all the inflation happened in the first half of the year. It's the month-on-month that I'm talking about, and it's now been 4 months. That number has changed. So you just think like a price is rising or falling today, like without making any statement about the future or the past, really. What are they doing now, relative to where they were a few weeks ago? Like, what's the current rate of change? That is negative almost across the board. Which is a huge dissonance to the way the market's positioned, because the story this year has been inflation's bad, Fed's hiking, and they're gonna have to hike into recession. And it's gonna get dramatically worse before it gets better. That's kind of how everyone's positioned. And you can see it in like record put premium, obviously the mass exit out of tech and growth, which we've been on the receiving end of. And all kinds of, like, it's just every, sentiment indicators, the prime brokerage leverage, all those kinds of things kind of show that everyone's positioned for like an awful bear market, which is actually, it's like that shift in positioning is what causes these sell-offs. It's really interesting. It's like the change in position is what causes it. So it's also kind of trivial to say, yeah, everyone's positioned for a crash when prices are down so much, or in equities have fallen so much, because obviously it's the positioning for the crash that causes that. But I think it's interesting because it could have gone the other way. If that inflation number came in hot, you could have 3 to 6 months of like further tightening. But now you've
And so
got.
what does this mean? This means that interest rates like either the rise in interest is gonna stop or slow, and then that's good for equity markets. Is that the kind of takeaway?
Yeah, that's one takeaway. I mean, bond yields have already come off significantly. So the market price of yields has come off a lot across the yield curve. And Fed officials are saying that they're going to look at slowing down the rate of increase. But they'll almost certainly raise by another 50 basis points in the US. But then that could even be the last one if these numbers continue coming in like this. Yeah, in terms of whether you buy equities, it's a weird one. I mean, there's a guy following on Twitter called Shrubbery Capital, which I highly recommend everybody follows. But he's kind of like, once some of these companies didn't have any clothes, they're like the emperor without any clothes, and the Fed's going to pivot, but you can't unsee what you've seen. And I think that's probably true. I think a lot of these companies are not going to recover. Certainly the multiples that we saw are just not going to be seen until there's a whole new generation of investors, probably. Mind you, memories are pretty short as well. I mean, tech's rebounded very strongly. Yeah, think about the tech crash to the GFC was like 5 years basically. A short period of time, and there's a whole cycle in between. So I think it's mixed. I think broadly for equities, it's probably pretty positive. It's hard to argue it's not positive. For the tech space, I think it's just going to be this huge diversion between companies that are unprofitable, unable to make money, and are diluting heavily, and the ones that kind of been okay the entire time and just down 60-70% because of the market. But they're still posting record revenues, record profits, record user growth. We're kind of in this moment where everything is still down. I guess industrials and things like that have started ripping, and small cap value has started going up. But we're still everything's still like, a lot of things are still at their lows or right near their lows. But I think there'll be huge dispersion now between the outcomes of all these different companies. Yeah, that's kind of my take.
I wanna I appreciate that. I like as you were talking, and we talk about this often, how when we speak from my end, I think in like probably 6, 12, 18 month cycles, just because private equity land is just slower, like it just takes, it's harder to do stuff, with illiquid assets, basically, we're either buying or selling, or and the life cycles of your ownership just last for a while. And when I speak to you, you think on like a daily, weekly, monthly basis. I recently wrote a like a semi review of Fooled by Randomness, and I think you and I spoke about this a little because I just read it for the first time. You read it a while ago. You loved it back in the day when you read it. I absolutely loved it. And one thing that really struck me, which I noticed a while ago, in private equity, like was the timing of checking in on a portfolio really matters. You could have a portfolio with an ex, really, and he, Taleb walks through the math, and I kind of write it up there. But you could be sitting on a great portfolio that has like a 90% chance of delivering a good return over a 12-month period. If you check in day to day, it's a coin flip whether it's going to perform good or bad. And so, like the reason I say this, and we can go into a lot more depth there, and we won't now. But the reason I say is that I think like the meta view of this podcast is that, it's like a weekly or fortnightly podcast. And so it's actually like we're fooled a little bit by randomness, like it's very hard to really change your view of what's going to happen over a 12-month view on a week-to-week basis. But because it's a podcast and because we kind of talk about what's kind of happening in the markets and what's interesting, we naturally fall into this kind of change in sentiment, which is like this absolute meta mistake our listeners should be aware of. Just kind of interesting to reflect.
Yeah, definitely. But I think the challenge in public markets is, I subscribe to that view and have. And I guess, the lesson, like one of the reasons that, I set up my fund and like our strategy was like just being really early on companies like Apple, Tesla, the growth stocks, and then kind of just being a bit too short term, trading out of them a little bit, not really capturing that full amount. And then just kind of like thinking hand on heart, I'm not going to do that again. If I want to a fast growing, great company that's really kicking goals, like I'm just not going to sell it. I want to get the 5-10 year outcome because I've seen how incredible those can be. And there's so many examples, and often, I own some of them for most of those journeys. But then
Can I
the flip
ask you
side is.
on that? Just how much of that, you and I are both kind of early to mid-30s. Our professional careers are defined by everything going up and to the right. We
Yeah.
just happen to live in that moment. How much of that outlook, it is how much of our outlook is like what you just described, be there for the long term, be invested in the top companies. Is that just like a moment, in time? I mean, I think that the tailwinds that kind of drove the growth over the last decade, like they'll be different. You're not going to have as much, they're not going to be like exactly the same, like moving from on-prem to SaaS or whatever. Or maybe that still is like the thing, but like you might not have Amazon and Facebook kind of popping to the same amount. But fundamentally, I'm probably still on balance bullish that those tech tailwinds are there. But how much are we being trapped in terms of that kind of our generation, the last decade mindset?
Yeah, look, I think that's kind of where I was going with it. I mean, there's two parts to that. So the first part is there's no doubt that like having spent 10 years in that environment, that meant that when you're now in, which has basically been like a 2-year bear market coming up to like a year and 10 months, That was like, I'm just trying to explain the philosophy we had before, which is in line with that. Don't check things, just go for the long term. But if price is going to go down and you wake up a year and 2 months, 10 months later, and everything is like lower than it has been at any point over that time. So basically a lot of these companies you could have bought at any time and they're down. That has been a challenge. It's a different environment. And it's funny when you speak to some other people and it's like where they started their careers really mattered. Like, did they see the GFC? Were they scarred by that? They probably did much better in the last 2 years, and then probably dramatically underperformed in that middle period. But also when it comes down to this market stuff, like how relevant was all that stuff to Tesla? Like not really. You know, they built an entire car company that's profitable and, you know, has margins like four times their competitors, building like basically the whole thing from scratch. It's not like they're pulling in components and they've kind of stitched together a company. You know, they make a lot of the stuff. And then the leader is, they're about to switch on self-driving. You know, they just announced that yesterday. So how much of that was part of the environment? Well, yeah, I mean, if there was a Great Depression of the last 10 years, probably wouldn't have.
Are they really going to switch on self-driving? I've been hearing that for 6 years. Are they really switching on?
I'm just telling you what he's announced. But yeah, I'll tell you what he has done, which is true. Basically, it can all the sensors are in every car to become self-driving, and they can update the software online. So you compare like that to even a Porsche, like for example, an entry-level Porsche, which I may or may not be familiar with. You know, those things, like they're almost like bricks. they don't get updated. You have no kind of insight into what's going on in the computer. He put the sensors and the ability to self-drive in every car. It's just a matter of updating the software online at the right time. And I think that's kind of phenomenal. And that would be a recurring revenue stream in every vehicle on the road.
It must be scary reading Fooled by Randomness as a fund manager. I mean, we're both like directionally in the fund managing kind of business, but you know, like mathematically, you know, in a cohort of, you know, he shows, you know, and it's kind of not that counterintuitive either, but like, you know, in a cohort, if even bad managers, you have a few that absolutely crush it, you know, over the medium to long term, like just by kind of numbers, and those are the ones we notice. Like, it's very hard to kind of self-reflect on what we do and try and pass luck versus skill, because it's not saying skilled fundies don't exist either, but it's just very hard to actually, you know, but there will be poor managers who by virtue of luck kind of emerge over time. But anyway, it's fundamentally quite a, I don't know if it's a, I was going to say it's a pessimistic book. I don't know if that's right. It's definitely got a kind of a cynical outlook, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I thought there was a Sohn conference and I just saw a report. I didn't go. I was in Tasmania, but you know, there was a guy there who was like a professional sports bettor, and he said like he's a similar message. He's like, there's a lot of luck involved.
Oh, what's that guy's name again?
I was trying to think about it just then.
Moma founder, isn't he?
Or yeah, is that called?
The
he's like 9 out of 10 people who tried what I do wouldn't succeed. I'm not sure.
David Walsh.
That's right. No, yeah.
Oh no,
the concept of overbetting. You know, you could argue that's
unbelievable kind of story. I mean, he basically became a gazillionaire or whatever from basically professional betting. He was saying some of his syndicate, I don't have the article in front of me, but he was saying some of his syndicate continue their betting and they've got like, you know, billions in volumes every year. So they basically go about arbing, you know, various races based on odds and their understanding of markets. Like today, like they've basically got this machine that just spits out cash. It's an unbelievable, like it's a world so different. They're effectively quants in betting markets is the way I understand it. And I kind of envy that. Like it seems like an awesome business to be in, and quite different to what I do.
I think it's so rare. That'd be harder to succeed in than funds management, even, I reckon. Because yeah, I knew some people that tried to make it in sports betting. I think it was just a slog, and it's that variance. You've got that such high variance, and like they're much more careful. Oh, he was very careful. He made big points about like not over betting, which obviously in that instance is kind of would be disastrous. But you know, if you've got people that try to become professional poker players and things like that, and you can get the wrong hand, like a hand at the different moment can make a huge difference in your entire outcome. Like that variance would be so difficult to live with, I think.
So what else is happening in markets? I saw Grindr IPO'd or did a SPAC.
Yeah, Grindr SPAC.
Yeah.
There have been many SPACs lately. It's kind of interesting because you get to see an insight into the company. I mean, the one thing that struck me was that they don't swipe, so you can kind of see.
Don't pretend you don't know how it works. Come on, man. I saw the deck. I thought, first of all, it's been obvious. It's a freaking phenomenon. Like all my gay mates, you know, have been like, you know, over the it's been an absolute institution for a while. So it's not surprising. Mm-hmm. And I guess like it's like the least surprising thing in the world that, you know, sex sells. It's funny how they try to obfuscate. It's like community and connection, whatever, in the pack. Like it's obviously, you know, a guy sex thing. And it's funny also, like, I don't know how it will value. A, it's like growing like a weed, and it's got like EBITDA margins of more than 50%, like happy days, like it's a hyper profitable thing. But you know, I remember someone posted comparing kind of OnlyFans to Substack, and Substack is obviously like a newsletter effectively, and OnlyFans obviously like, you know, live porn and or what they kind of euphemistically call in VC land like the creator economy. But you know, like Substack, you know, written newsletters and OnlyFans are like normally part of the same broader creator ecosystem or whatever, but like I reckon OnlyFans is like 100 times as big. Like obviously, again, not surprising. You know, sex sells, sex is profitable, sex is like a big part of like, you know, what we don't talk about and what businesses kind of don't normally touch. But I wonder if, like, you know, Grindr obviously has the gay thing, and it's able to wrap itself up in like you know, a pro social aura in some respects. And so I wonder if it's able to like OnlyFans probably tries to wrap itself out and up in empowerment or something. I wonder if institutionally, you know, institutions probably can't invest in like brothels or something, I presume, or like, you know, it's probably not ESG. I wonder if Grindr is ESG or anti ESG. It's a little bit unclear.
And I'd have to say, I reckon that'd come down hard on the pro ESG side for that.
I reckon it would. You'd go, what do you mean it's not ESG? Are you not supporting the LGBTQ community?
OnlyFans. I think that would be a tough one. Is only
it would be a tough one, but I reckon even I reckon it probably not ESG, but this is where I was kind of going. Linktree is pro, okay? And for those who don't know, Linktree, I don't know what its latest valuation is, something over $1 billion, started in Melbourne. Good on the guys, fantastic. Basically, it creates a link on a social media profile where you can go to a person's you know, various links. You know, I use it for my, you know, newsletter and podcast and whatever. But really, Linktree basically grew out of Instagram, and like I don't know the exact percentages. It comes from OnlyFans or from like influencers, but like my guess is like a meaningful part of its monetization and a meaningful part of its usership is effectively through OnlyFans. And so it's the perfect, you know, if VCs can't own the mine, like they can't own porn or whatever it is, it's a perfect selling picks and shovels to the mine. It's like it's perfect cover for getting exposure to porn, basically, which is genius, right? Like good on the VCs, good on the, you know, the founders, whatever. But like it's interesting. It made me think, like, how else, if you're an investor, you're unable to kind of get direct exposure to the darker side of some of these things, you know, how else might you innocuously give yourself cover to kind of to get that exposure?
I guess there's a couple. So there's a couple of listed nightclub owners in the US. Then OnlyFans, like this is, I mean, I think we talked about on the podcast that then I didn't save or didn't record. You know, this is amazing. Like they made like 500 million US or something of profits. And the one bit that I thought was fascinating was the guy that owns it now didn't actually set it up. So, you know, you'll be aware that there's all these sites you can go on and buy an e-commerce site for 50 grand, 100 grand, $5 million, you know, or a Shopify store, or Amazon store, or, you know, I don't know, an iPhone app that makes 20K a year. Like there's a marketplace for these things. And the guy that bought it, like the guy that owns it, made all this money. Like it only took off after he bought it. So he bought it off somebody else and then pivoted. Well,
let me tell you another inspirational story, kind of like that. About 10 years ago, one of my former bosses in banking quit. He went, he DD'd like, I don't know, a few dozen businesses on this business directory sites. These aren't online or e-com businesses, like real businesses. Okay. He ended up buying, a couple of mil or something. He ended up buying like a health products logistics business here in Sydney. He'd run it. He just sold a part of it for, closer, in the many tens of millions of dollars. Okay. Yeah. And I just think, like, kudos to him, guy in his early 40s, kind of left advisory land, which is super different to kind of operator / investor / principal land, and has successfully acquired and personally grown and transformed this business at that time. And I just think, like, I don't know, I found that deeply inspirational, because I kind of probably don't have as much faith generally in the skills of bankers, and also I just think kind of like that process is and that conviction to do it and then successfully execute on it is just like, kudos to him. So just kind of like your OnlyFans story, like, I think you don't need to be Mark Zuckerberg or whatever kind of coding in your backyard. You can kind of do the work and use your smarts and build something meaningful.
Yeah, and I guess you got your whole life to kind of find things that work, right? So
yeah,
probably get multiple rolls of those dice.
So you went to, I don't know, remember the name, Sunrise or whatever it is, like Blackbirds. Blackbirds, obviously one of the top Australian VCs. They host some sort of conference. Could you explain what it is? And you went there and what it was like and what the vibe is among VCs?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conference. It was 2 days. I was there for 1 day. It's interesting because there's obviously a lot of people in the broad startup community that go. So it's, people that want to be VCs, a lot of portfolio companies, a lot of people looking for fundraising.
So can you just rock up, or is it like a ticketed thing? Or like,
ticketed, yeah. But okay. I think you just buy a ticket online.
And so do other VCs rock up, or is it like a competitive thing and they don't run?
Other VCs like presented on stage, Jackie at Airtree, she gave a talk. There are other people that I didn't see that.
Is that weird? Like, is that weird that they platform
I asked the Blackbird people about it. They said, no, it's just they're going to come anyway, so may as well invite them. But it kind of shows, I think Blackbird's done such a phenomenal job in Australia, to create that community. Like, they really are the first people you think of. And it comes down to things like that. Like, just
all. Oh, it's a massive flex. Like, sure, competitors come. Like, you come to our conference, fine.
Imagine investors in Blackbird go as well. Because it was interesting. They're so efficient, those things, because you just bump into so many people you've met over the years. Maybe you've invested a bit in them, or you've met them, or, bump into so many people, which otherwise I just can't even imagine how painful it would be to organize coffees and catch-ups with 20 or 30 people like that. You can just do it in a day.
Hmm.
It was good. I highly recommend if people are interested in the space, they go next year.
And so what's the vibe? Like, we've spoken a couple of times. I'd say VC has been, it's probably been the toughest year in VC, just looking from the outside, in at least 5 or 6 years. 5 or 6 years, it's been just, absolute hockey stick up. This year, I think deal flow has been massively down. A lot of their portfolio companies have been marked down. Big parts of their portfolios have been in trouble. I think obviously people with crypto assets are sweating it. People with like fake meat assets are probably sweating it. Like Beyond Meat looks like it's gone from like
Oh my god, did you see those photos of like the factory where there's like mold and like all these big chemical vats?
I haven't seen it, but like it looks like, and again, we're looking now, maybe in 5 years there'll be something else and it'll look wonderful and maybe sentiment will change, but today it looks freaking dire. So like big chunks of like, all the kind of food delivery and stuff, like all the CapEx heavy cracks look really difficult. So, I don't know the details, but I reckon a lot of VCs are sweating it. Not Blackbird, Stellar, they've got enough kind of wins. Excellent, like the top will probably be fine. But like, and you've had all some emergence of all these like random B grade VCs. I won't name any names. I got this random email the other day of these like, folks who are trying to raise a fund. I think they've been kind of, kicking the can for a while. I just thought, like who on earth is funding these specific individuals who look like totally inept and they've got awful track records. And I don't mean, you know, again, I'm not naming anyone, but like this just feels like this oversupply of like you know, VCs in the market. And so given that backdrop, how was like, was any of that sentiment kind of shining through?
Look, there's a little bit. I mean, it came up in every conversation, that's for sure. This was right when that SBF FTX saga was just breaking. If I hope they haven't got the dates mixed up, but from memory, it was just breaking then. And, you know, with them going under, so many people, so many crypto startups used them, put all their crypto with them, like set up with them. Like that, them going under was like the death knell for like probably hundreds, maybe thousands of companies. But then there was like this NFT section on stage, and there's just like this dissonance between this absolute chaos that's going on outside in crypto and then like this NFT, these people just talking about NFTs and the money they've, like the success they'd had in that field. that seemed like a bit of like, what's the right word, anachronism or atavistic or whatever it is, where it was just like, yeah, there was kind of, sorry, someone just walked in. Yeah, it just seemed like a dissonance. Wasn't there like a big mood of, you know, everything's kind of, I don't know. I think coming to what you say, I think it's, everyone's just going to be starved of oxygen and then some people are going to survive and then, you know, everything just goes, but you're getting, I'm sure you're getting a lot of like emergency funding emails, things like that. Like it's been basically what, a year, the market probably shut decisively end of 2021, we're now end of 2022. Now companies, if companies can like survive on their own, then it's almost irrelevant that that market is shut. If they're relying on funding, well, they've probably just burned through a year. And then it'll come down to how much they're prepared for and how much cash, and like could even be a bit of luck. But it's pretty clear if you're in that space that you're best served. You know, there's very little money coming out. And of course, Blackbird and Airtree and those funds will still be writing checks. But I imagine they're only doing them to the very best companies. And the ones that we've seen, we co-invested in a couple. It's all convertible debt. It's all pretty strict, extremely strict terms. Which is another problem, like which we've talked about, when you've got these companies with like these layers of preferential, you know, it's not even just layers of preferential debt where they get paid first. And then you've got, obviously, you know, even companies like Shopify and Spotify are down 80%, 85%. You know, if you consider that they're kind of leading and compare that to what private market could have done if they're listed, you know, where would like the listed price of those companies be? All of a sudden in a situation where like founders kind of get wiped out, and founders probably walk away with something, but employees certainly do. Like there's very little protections in those employee stock option plans. It's pretty tough environment. I think like public equities, that was our bad year. My guess is already there's things are bottoming, things are kind of stabilizing, things are rallying. They've kind of moved sideways for 6 months. And then, you know, industrials and things are, you know, are rallying pretty strongly. But my guess is the private markets comes now, you know, the next 6 to 12 months, because no one's had to really, there haven't been those difficult conversations. Like, no, everyone raised enough money that they could easily survive a year. Like it'd be pretty poor management if you couldn't survive 12 months without funding, or at least get some kind of bridge funding. But 2 years, like very few startups have 2 years of cash, I think, or would have had 2 years of cash at the end of last year. And so maybe I'd say it's over the next year that comes to roost. And then, you know, the companies are going to have to go to their backers and say, look, you know, we need to keep the lights on. And then it'll kind of be up to the investors where they decide to which companies they are willing and able to support.
I'll tell you a funny anecdote. I recently, from, you know, in a kind of private equity context, looked at a more mature asset that's probably still, you'd say it's probably still in startup land. And you know, the deck looked unbelievable. And we thought, this is super interesting. You kind of dig in and you realize, you notice, you know, the metrics aren't, we'll say politely, calculated in the way that we would have thought. And what's actually happening on an underlying basis is very different and very bad. And so
the financials were different to what they're...
Well, no, like, well, you know, the actual numbers, but like, call it like, you know, like typical things you'd look at, like cohort retentions or like, you know, underlying, you know, revenue retention and the like. So basically a customer's numbers going up or they're going down over time, basically. And it, it, And so it turned out to be, you know, not what we what we thought it was. Okay. And it was a kind of a no, that kind of happened. That's fine. It did, you know, but it did take a bit of digging and a bit of work to actually figure out, not like that much, probably, you know, a couple of days or something. But it's probably like way more DD than I do on my personal startup investments, which are just like way more lax. Like, it's obviously not institutional, it's just like me punt having a punt or whatever half the time, or like it's vibe driven, or like you're backing a founder or something. And I just I'm too scared to go back and look at like the actual numbers for a bunch of companies I've invested in, because I reckon if I actually applied a proper DD eye, which you you probably shouldn't, it's not that hard, you kind of walk away, I'd walk away a lot more frightened than just kind of the headline numbers that are sold to you in a deck. So I don't know, I just reckon, and again, not this is no one's fault, I think it's only investors' fault if they just don't do their DD, obviously, and founders are expected to kind of put their best foot forward. But like, it just made me reflect on myself and like, you know, what have probably been a few like undercooked decisions relative to what I do in my professional life.
I mean, it was an exciting time, you know, a year ago, a year and a half ago. It felt like anyone could raise a company like that. You know, you'd find customers easy, that, you know, there were people like just kind of doing extremely well really quickly, and kind of felt like I had this weird vibe that anything was kind of possible. There were all those random people that made all those fortunes in crypto.
Yeah. Well, that's, and then now the, it's that's the bull
like,
market.
It really
yeah.
is hangover now. It's like, well, not only did a lot of those, like how many of those crypto startups will actually generate anything, you know, and they were the most, probably the most egregious private valuations were in crypto land, I'd say.
So I have a question.
Even more
for
than
you.
Software.
I reckon, you know, I didn't like live through the GFC, like lose my job or something, but I started my graduate job after uni in 2010, and I walked into seats, basically they had just been emptied as like whole floors were sacked, basically. Like, it was a pretty dire time, you know. I heard the stories about the margin calls, like I definitely kind of witnessed and as an intern felt the whole GFC thing around me, and that did imprint something on my mind. Do you think the exuberance of the last decade, A, has aimed to teach us, B, will kind of change our behavior in the future, or, you know, is everyone just kind of in for the ride and, you know, we'll say we're wise, but really, you know, we'll just get distracted by the next shiny thing, go up when things go up and go down when things go down? And I know you have investors, and so you have to say you're wise. And I work at a fund that has investors, and so I have to say I'm really wise, and we've learned, and you know how brilliant we are, and how everyone else is an idiot. But if we just park that for a moment, what do you?
Yeah, look, I knew I started probably a similar time, so I was kind of like interning around that period. So it was great because you got to speak to people. Often people had lost everything, like multi-billion-dollar businesses, multi-billion-dollar funds. And I always kind of wanted to get into funds management. So I kind of made it my business to speak as many of those people as I could. That's what kind of, it's baffling to have been caught up in this particular crash, you know, when you think about it. It's like spent years and years like studying this stuff. I think ultimately there were huge waves that supported everything, you know, whether it was e-commerce, software, digital ads, everybody getting a smartphone, no smartphone to everybody getting a smartphone. There will be other ones like that. I think, yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I'm sure those times will return. One thing I'm kind of wary of, which could be happen, is let's say like you had the tech crash, which I think has a lot to kind of talk about, a lot of similarities and a lot of lessons for like the current period. And then it was like 5 years to 2007. And then all the action was happening in mortgages. Bizarrely, it seems strange now, but you know, like there's probably hundreds of people getting like 10, 20, 30 million dollar bonuses on Wall Street for packaging up mortgage derivatives. When you look at the list of the highest paid Wall Street people, it's like, whoa, I can't believe people actually got paid that for a job. And then there was another crash which took many companies back to where they were. And that was when you had like negative 10-year returns for equities and many companies as well. So you feel like the starting valuation points are high enough here that you could have, you know, rolling waves of crisis, maybe one or two. Look, I think the biggest lesson for everyone is when those times are good, like that's the time to achieve whatever you want to achieve. So if you want to start up a business, I'm not thinking of funds management. I'm thinking of like if you want to start up a business, there's times when years where people throw money at that and they really want to give people a go and there's lots of money sloshing around. It's not just a QE period. There's been many, many, many periods throughout history where that's been the case. And I think if you find yourself in one of those periods, like that is the moment to go for it, set up your business and go. And you think about who are the people that did the best over the last 10 years, it was absolutely not the people in finance, you know, it was the people that built businesses. And not necessarily built them, like fucking 20th person at Facebook or 50th person at Google, you know, people that helped build these things. You know, that was, I think when the times are good, that's the moment where you try and raise money for your brilliant idea and like try and really make something happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. I think it'll be years before people are interested in things that don't have weight, you know? I think like things need to have weight. Like you won't be able to do product management software. You won't be able to do an app. You won't be able to raise lots of money for an app. You'll need to have something of substance, but then absolutely there'll be money for that. What do you think? What do you think there's obviously lessons like my reflections and my lessons, you know, it's, you can't be kind of long at the top. You can't be full guns blazing. The problem with long-term investing is you do go through these 1-2 year bear markets, probably 3-4 times in your life. So they're pretty rare. Like there can be, there's multiple debt, there's 20 year periods where they don't happen. And then there's 10 year periods where you might get two, like the tech wreck and the GFC. And we're having one now. So there's certainly people that have seen three. If you were a professional in 2000, this is your third one. But then nobody was around in the 70s other than like, say, perhaps Buffett, you know, and that was the previous or even the early 80s. So they're pretty rare, these things. There's definitely ways that you'd play it completely differently going forward. But hey, maybe they're deep reflections for another time. I'm not sure. I don't know how deep you want to go.
No. It's just interesting. I mean, I think you got to be in it to win it. Like to your kind of point, like even if you recognize exuberance, you know, you've got to, you know, if you're not in, you lost a ton of money kind of calling out the exuberance for a decade, basically. My philosophy was basically don't invest anything I can't lose, fundamentally, like just taking a view that, you know, yeah, if I chuck something into this and it kind of goes to zero, you know, will I live to fight another day and feed my family or whatever? And so at the end of the day, I can, you know, I was always kind of long my own survival in a sense. Professionally, you know, I think a lot of funds in private equity land have, you know, have capital to deploy. So, you know, there's genuinely a kind of through the cycle hedge there as well, almost. But yeah, so I don't have any kind of deep wisdom. I think obviously we'll be reflecting on how to kind of position ourselves, you know, going forward. But yeah, no, it's just kick it around.
Yeah, and there's still some things like the tech forward thing. Still completely believe in that. And even then, look at the AI stuff that we've talked about in this pod. You know,
yeah,
crazy what's happened. So innovation seems to be actually accelerating. And then that has opened up a huge amount and that has huge investment consequences. So semiconductors, they're notoriously cyclical. In the early 70s, for example, they dropped like 90, 95 plus, like 98, 99% in some cases for companies that actually survived. And then at the back end of every crisis, they go up between 4 and 10 times. Like they're just ultra cyclical. And we went through the fastest little cycle then where, you know, a few months ago, everyone's talking about chip shortages and you can't buy a car. And then all of a sudden there's chip oversupply and all the stocks are down 65, 70%, or kind of 50 to 65%. But at the same time, we know that, you know, there's going to be immense demand for this artificial intelligence. We're all going to have like computers spinning around, like telling us what to do. And then cars are getting like the semiconductor in cars is probably going to quadruple. It's like the whole thing just becomes, you know, a computer in a way that just wasn't before. And so you can already see like the sources of future demand and innovation. And then, so I reckon like those kinds of companies are already starting to bounce pretty strongly, even though their numbers are pretty bad. I think people are just recognizing the future of that. And I think there'll be a ton of, I mean, that's the first one that comes to mind. I think life science is kind of interesting because it's going through such a weird bust at the moment where there's still hundreds of companies trading for less than cash. At the same time as like all these avenues of development have just opened up. mRNA, and there's like another number of different types of, genetic engineering that have kind of come to maturity. There will be fortunes made there. I think it'd be hard from a stock. It's very hard from a stock perspective because the companies that have the technology, you're paying billions of dollars for companies with no products, which is pretty hard at the moment. And then, yeah, it's hard to get outsized returns in the majors. They're worse, the best performing sectors. There's weight loss drugs and anti-aging. So the weight loss drugs have come of age. So they can't even make enough. What do they call it? Semaglutide, Wegovy, where you can lose 10, 15, the new drugs, perhaps 20, 25% of your body weight just with like a weekly injection. Like that will have probably profound impacts on society and people's lives. And also be one of the some of the like that that's tens of billions of dollars a year going into the pharmaceutical industry. So there's heaps of things going on. And then I was having a chat with a friend. It's like you forget that I'm obviously caught up in the dead day because we stare at the stuff and we see it every day and obviously investor contact every day and all that kind of stuff. But most people in the world are barely even aware that anything's going on. Like the fact there's a tech
Sure.
crash is just like completely irrelevant to most people's lives. Most people are teachers, policemen, bakers, just doing stuff, working for the government. These are huge sectors that all this stuff is just completely irrelevant. It's going to tick on, and they're going to upgrade the TV every now and then, buy a new computer for the kids, buy a car when someone turns 18, 19. They're just that base level of economy stuff will just keep ticking along. So yeah, I don't think the doomsday, I still don't see the doomsday. I still don't think it's going to happen. I think we're probably pretty close to the end here.
Awesome. Should we leave it on that kind of semi-optimistic note?
Yeah, sounds good. Let's do it. Thanks, Misha.
Awesome. That was fun.
Speak soon. Bye.